Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do chapter 15 and 16 of Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds by Professor Robert S. Griffin, who created what he called a portrait of William Luther Pierce 10 plus years ago. And we've already done the first 14 chapters, which detail Pierce's background and the formation of the National Alliance, his personal life, biographical details, and also his intellectual provenance, the people he's in the direct line of, and today we'll continue that. So, starting with chapter 15, I should say first, everything that we do is part of Vanguard Audiobooks, which we style the Learning College, which is all about pure learning, not about teaching you ideology or getting you in debt or teaching you to be sexually and in other ways loose and vice-ridden. It's just teaching you stuff. That's what this is all about. This is why we're spending the time to do it. We hope some of you appreciate it and get something from it, because you can actually learn things. But that's what a college ought to be about, purely about learning. And that's what Learning College is about. You can find this and everything that we do, everything that we record, at vnnforum.com. With that said, let's get started with Chapter 15, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Chapter 15 is titled Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian who came over to the West, wrote the Gulag Archipelago, and numerous other works, and more recently wrote 200 Years Together about Jews and Russians, in which he basically did what white racialists and Nazis and other people have done, is place the blame for communism on Jews squarely where it belongs. Make them bear the burden of their sins and their actions. Make them take responsibility for what they've done. And the Jews saw to it that it wasn't translated in the West, but parts of it have been. Outside of the major houses, it's inconceivable that as big of a name as Alexander Solzhenitsyn wouldn't have his work translated into English, but it runs against the Jewish agenda, which is anti-white, so of course they deny it. Chapter 15, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, starting on page 198. So we've made our way halfway through the book. Now we begin the second half. Griffin says, I understand you've read a lot that Alexander Solzhenitsyn has written, I said to Pierce. Bob DeMars had mentioned it to me. Has Solzhenitsyn had a major influence on your thinking? Solzhenitsyn wrote A World Split Apart back in the 70s. That was his address to the Harvard shortly after coming to the West, and that's fairly famous. A World Split Apart details a point of view that's very much against what the main trends in the West. And my favorite Solzhenitsyn quote is basically he said, unless you're willing to die, there is no real defending yourself. It's just expediency and, you know, kind of stopgapping. He said it much more eloquently, but I don't really have it memorized. Just remember the quote. It neatly explains. The minute you start striking blows and show that you're not fearless, you begin attracting people of actual caliber to your side. Of course, you assume the ones striking the blows also have some quality, but a cause that only suffers blows is not an attractive cause. Has Solzhenitsyn had a major influence in your thinking? Asks Griffin. Pierce responds, I have read some of what Solzhenitsyn has written, although he is not really in a direct line of my development. I didn't read him until after my own views were pretty well formulated. I did find him interesting, however, and mined some facts from what he had written. For example, I read the commencement address he gave at Harvard in 1978. That's A World Split Apart. You can find it in printed form. It's a shortish, small little work, because it's a commencement address. It had been published and distributed widely. I said to myself, this guy is one of the very few people who has had the courage to come right out and say these things in public, as opposed to the milquetoast blather that you get in virtually all commencement addresses. I really appreciated that he said things that needed to be said, fundamental and true things that probably no one else with access to that forum would have told these Harvard seniors and their parents. In my own way, I am trying to get a message to this society about the radical changes we need to make, and even though I don't agree with everything with Solzhenitsyn about everything, I respected what he did at Harvard. And what he would mean is Solzhenitsyn is very Christian, and although there would have been a big overlap in the problems that he saw with the West, he would have attributed it to a moral religious decline, a decline in lack of faith in Christianity. That's where Pierce would have disagreed. Alexander Solzhenitsyn is a Russian writer born in 1918 who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970. His books include One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, August 14, 1914, The First Circle, and The Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn was arrested in 1945 for anti-Stalinist remarks and eventually ended up in a hard labor camp in Kazakhstan. His writings, some of which were written on scraps of paper while he was interned, depict the harsh conditions of the labor camps and blame Stalin for their existence. Solzhenitsyn attacked the Soviet Communist Party, and in 1973 he was expelled from the Soviet Union and came to the United States, where he lived in Vermont, which is where Griffin is also. Solzhenitsyn's champions in this country were appalled to learn that his vision wasn't of a democracy, but rather a theocracy based on the precepts of the Russian Orthodox Church. While in America, Solzhenitsyn decried the growing decadence of Western society. In 1994, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the changed political conditions in Russia, he returned to his home country. Solzhenitsyn gave the Harvard commencement address that Pierce referred to on June 8, 1978. Between 10 and 15,000 people gathered in the drizzling rain to hear the words of this celebrated author. Solzhenitsyn entitled his talk, "A World Split Apart." He didn't say anything on that occasion that he hadn't been saying for years, but nevertheless many were surprised as well as put off by what they heard. "The West is in a fight for its spiritual survival," Solzhenitsyn told his audience, "and its adversary is modernity itself. The modern world had brought with it, quote, moral poverty," unquote, Solzhenitsyn declared, "and, quote, the calamity of an autonomous, irreligious, humanistic consciousness." 200 or even 50 years ago, he proclaimed, it would have seemed quite impossible, in America, that an individual be granted boundless freedom with no purpose, simply for the satisfaction of his whims. And then later, "Is it true that man is above everything? Is there no superior spirit above him? Is it right that man's life and society's activities should be ruled by material expansion above all? Is it permissible to promote such expansion to the detriment of our integral spiritual life?" Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement address was met with strong criticism from liberal quarters. The New York Times editorialized, quote, "Mr. Solzhenitsyn's worldview seems to us far more dangerous than the easygoing spirit which he finds so exasperating. Life in a society run by zealots like Mr. Solzhenitsyn is bound to be uncomfortable for those who do not share his vision or ascribe to his beliefs." Of course, the liberals and Jews running New York Times are in no way zealots. Just look at how things have eventuated now, where you're forced to bake cake for people you don't like, and they're talking about zealotry. The Washington Post accused him of a, quote, "gross misunderstanding of Western society, which has chosen to organize its political and social and cultural affairs on the basis of the differences among men." I told Pierce that I had recently read a biography of Solzhenitsyn and that I was struck by some of the similarities between his outlook and Pierce's. I was thinking of Solzhenitsyn's opposition to materialism, rationalism, and individualism, and his authoritarianism, spirituality, and what appears to be his anti-Semitism. And then there is his affinity for nature and the non-urban life. He said he chose to live in Cavendish, Vermont because of the, quote, "simple way of life of the people, the countryside, and the long winters with the snow." There is even Solzhenitsyn's total immersion in his work. Quote, "All my life consists of only one thing, work." That reminds me of Pierce's complete investment of himself in his work. "I can see how you could say that," Pierce responded, "but there are a lot of differences between Solzhenitsyn and me, too. Hell, I don't even know the man, so I can't be sure. But I think that Solzhenitsyn is a lot more Christian than I am. In fact, I'm not a Christian at all. I don't put any stock in that. And I imagine he is much more of a sober character than I am. For example, when I relax with a video, it is likely to be something like a James Bond movie. Sex and violence, that's what I like. I get kind of strung out at work, a lot of frustrations and so forth, and watching a really violent film has a cathartic effect on me. Damn it, give it to the son of a bitch! I don't picture Solzhenitsyn doing that. And I always try to do, within limits anyway, what is natural. I'm sort of a nudist by nature. Of course I don't run around naked in the office, but at home I do. I don't see Solzhenitsyn doing anything like that. One of the things I was thinking about is the way Solzhenitsyn portrays Jews negatively in his books. I noticed that in First Circle, Pierce replied, in that book, three major Jewish characters, Reuben, Kagan, and Reutemann, R-O-I-T-M-A-N, are depicted as defenders of evil. It's in August 1914, too, I said. Parentheses, the anarchist and assassin Bogrov, Jewish, is weak and cowardly, a spineless intellectual, attached to luxury, self-pitying, and described with serpentine imagery. Quote, I should read that book. I got started on it, but then something happened and I didn't finish it. I've noticed, I said to Pierce, that when Solzhenitsyn has been questioned about his anti-Semitism, he denies it. He says, oh no, I have nothing against the Jews. These are isolated characters who just happen to be Jews. I am simply describing history. Now remember, what Griffin is saying is before Solzhenitsyn wrote 200 years together. So he wrote that after Griffin finished this portrait of Pierce. So, in fact, he did know the facts about Jews, and he did set them down, at least in the form of history, rather than, you know, drawing generalizations and general conclusions about Jews, as I guess he apparently did in 200 Years Together, which I have not read, so, other than translated excerpts I've seen. I don't know what Solzhenitsyn's views about Jews really are, says Griffin, but he may think along the same lines as you do and made a tactical decision as to how most to effectively express what he thinks given the situation he is in. Have you ever thought it might be better for you if you muted your criticism of Jews some, been more diplomatic about it, that maybe you would be able to reach more people if you approached it that way instead of head-on? Maybe it would be easier for me if I came at it that way, but see, I've been doing this for 32 years, and while I suppose for all that time I could have taken on a role that was unnatural to me, I just didn't want to do it. The only way for me to do what is natural to me, and that is to say what I really believe and really feel. I'm not being critical of Solzhenitsyn, I'm just talking about my way. Besides, I think it is necessary for somebody to be an extremist, for somebody to say it all, even the things that frighten people or that they don't want to hear. I think that is my natural role. Others who are a lot more people-oriented than I am, who are more accustomed to adjusting what they say and do because of their interactions with other people, they can give a more moderate message that is a lot easier for the average person to accept. But that is not my way. Perhaps I could have done it that way for a while, but I don't think I could have done it for as long as I've been doing this work. In a certain way, what I am doing is self-indulgent. Very few people are as able as I am to indulge themselves by saying exactly what they want to say. Most people have to interact with a lot of different types of individuals every day. They have to be diplomatic and careful in what they say, and that makes sense. You can't go around offending your neighbors and co-workers. Tact and politeness and those kind of things are important in keeping society running smoothly. I try to be polite. I try not to offend people unnecessarily. But at the same time, I'll be the guy who goes ahead and says it when other people don't. If I figure out something and think it is true and important and ought to be said, I say it. I don't hold back. I don't moderate it. I don't round off the rough edges to avoid offending people. Now, that isn't entirely true. There are some times when there is no point in getting a lot of hairy and off-putting details on something if they can be described in terms that are a bit obtuse. A word to the wise is sufficient. The right people will understand the message without having to stampede the sheep. But mostly, let's put it that way, I indulge myself in the luxury of telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth as I see it. That's one of the payoffs of doing this work. Exactly right. And that's the end of the chapter on Solzhenitsyn. Now we move, page 202, to chapter 16 on Bob Matthews. The 1983 National Alliance's annual convention was held in September in Washington, D.C., 83 in D.C., and Pierce invited a young mine worker from the Pacific Northwest by the name of Bob Matthews to give a talk, M-A-T-H-E-W-S. Matthews had been an Alliance member for 3 years and actively recruiting new members for Pierce's organization among the farmers and ranchers and working people around where he lived in Washington State. Pierce asked him to tell the people at the convention about how that effort was going, as well as about the situation generally in his part of the country. Bob agreed to do that and wrote out his speech on his dining table at home and flew out to Washington for the conference. Pierce looked forward to Bob's talk and publicized it in the monthly bulletin he sent out to Alliance members. He included Bob's picture in a short write-up on Bob's recruiting activities. What Pierce didn't know was that what Bob had in mind to do. Bob had really taken to the Turner Diaries. He pored over every word in the book and gave it to his friends to read along with the highest recommendation. But the thing about Bob was that he wasn't content to just read the book and agree with what it said. Bob was a man of action. He had a fire burning inside him. That is what people said about him. He was going to create an order of his own, like the one in the book, and start a revolution like the one he had read about. Bob meant business. Bob's talk was awaited with a measure of anticipation by the 100 or so in attendance at the convention because of the picture and write-up that had appeared in the Alliance Bulletin. The Bob Matthews they saw at the podium that day was a boyish-looking man of 30 years of age. He was about 5'7" and had a trim, muscular build. He was good-looking with even facial features. His dark brown hair was short and parted to the side, and it tended to fall forward onto his forehead. Those who knew Bob said he had hazel eyes that shined with intensity and purpose. That was what you noticed about him when you looked at him, they said. Most people who came to know Bob saw him as a serious and forceful person, and they liked him. Even those who detested his politics liked Bob the man. In pictures I have seen of him, he reminds me of an enlisted man home on leave, or another association that comes to mind, the young working-class fathers I see walking past the stores in a shopping mall with their wives, their young children in a stroller. An audio tape exists of Matthew's talk. His voice is youthful. There is a tension and fervor in his delivery that gives a sense of immediacy and electricity to the occasion. Bob talked about 10 minutes or so, not long. Excerpts from what he had to say that day in the late summer of 1983 give a sense of his message. Here's a black quote from Bob Matthews in 1983, the leadership conference out in Washington, D.C. "My brothers and sisters from the mist-shrouded forested valleys and mountains of the Pacific Northwest, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty as members of a vanguard of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. The signs of awakening are sprouting up across the Northwest, and no more than among the two-fisted farmers and ranchers. The task is not going to be easy. TV satellite dishes are springing up like poisonous mushrooms across the domain of the tillers of the soil. The electronic Jew is slithering into the living rooms of even the most remote farms and ranches. The race-destroying dogs are everywhere. In Medellin Falls, we have broken the chain of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine. It is ours, our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, 1 beat. 100 hearts, 1 beat. 10,000 hearts, 1 beat. We were born to fight and die and to continue the flow of our people. The future is now, so stand up like men and drive the enemy to the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Look toward the stars and proclaim our destiny. In Medellin Falls we have a saying, defeat never, victory forever." Bob's talk received a standing ovation. He would be dead in a little over a year. Robert J. Matthews was born, and again that's M-A-T-H-E-W-S. Robert J. Matthews was born in Marfa, M-A-R-F-A, Texas in 1953 and grew up in Arizona around Phoenix. From the time he was a teenager, Bob had a fierce racial pride in being a Caucasian. It wasn't merely a matter of his being prejudiced against minorities, harboring antagonistic feelings toward them, resenting them, as is usually attributed to whites who hold strong racial views. Bob wasn't so much against anything as he was for something. White people. He held the conviction that it was white men who had created the greatness that is Western civilization. He was also convinced that America was in decline and that whites were being brought down to far less than they once were, and that they had to do something about that. When still a teenager, he joined the John Birch Society and he tried to start a survivalist group called the Sons of Liberty, but that didn't get very far. Bob also got involved with the tax protest movement in Arizona. He wound up getting arrested and put on probation for not paying his taxes. After high school, Bob didn't go on to college, much to the disappointment of his parents. Bob told them that he didn't want to go through all the liberal propaganda they shoved down your throat in college, and anyway, he wanted to get on with his life. He wanted to get out of Phoenix, that was for sure. There were too many laws, too many urban problems, too many minorities, and just too many people in general. So when he was in his early 20s, Bob got out a map of North America and started running his finger over it. His finger came to rest on an isolated village in Washington State, Medellin Falls, the last town before the Canadian border. Bob loaded up his pickup and drove to Medellin Falls to begin a new life. Right away, he found a laboring job in a lead and zinc mine. One writer describes the place Bob went to in these terms, block quote on Medellin Falls, "Minorities were virtually absent from the Medellin Falls area, and a white man living there could imagine that he was existing in a country that wasn't ethnically diverse or full of crowded, complicated cities. A man could dream of starting over here, of rebuilding his life from scratch. Matthews also loved the landscape the town was set in. Canada's Selkirk Mountains rose in the distance. At dawn, full-grown deer walked across the main street of Medellin Falls. Heavy snow only made the hills and evergreens more beautiful. God's country. It was the kind of climate one would find in Northern Europe, where the Aryan and Scandinavian peoples had flourished before their heirs came to America. In centuries past, those ethnic groups had given rise to Norse and Viking sagas, grand tales of the courage and strength of northern warriors in battle. They had no fear of death. If they perished heroically, the Valkyries, the handmaidens of Odin, the supreme being of Norse mythology, would whisk their souls away to Valhalla, where they'd be enshrined in the Great Hall of Immortality. A modern-day religion, Odinism, has sprung from these sagas. Bob Matthews was familiar with it. He liked it. He regarded it the same way he regarded the Northwestern Passage. Both could inspire a man to become a hero. It wasn't long before Bob could afford to buy 50 acres of land in the area and put a mobile home on it. Bob tried a lot of ways to make the land profitable over the years, crops and such, but nothing ever really panned out. Bob wanted to start a family, and he met his wife in an unconventional way through an ad in the nationally circulated Mother Earth News. His ad read, quote, "Looking for a mature, intelligent woman, 18 to 25, to share my life and land in Washington." Eventually, 130 women replied. The letter that most caught Bob's attention was from a Kansan who had moved to Wyoming after college by the name of Debbie McGarity. Debbie wrote to Bob that she thought the most important job a woman could do was to raise children. "You can't have a good society unless the home is a decent place," Debbie wrote. Bob drove to Wyoming to meet Debbie. They hit it off, and she moved to Medellin Falls, and they were married in 1976. As it turned out, Debbie and Bob didn't have children of their own, but they did adopt a son. Later, a couple of months before his death, Bob was to have a child of his own, a daughter with a woman he met through the movement, Zilla Craig, Z-I-L-L-A-H, and C-R-A-I-G. Right after Bob returned home from his speech at the National Alliance Convention, he gathered together 8 men in a barracks-like structure he had erected near his mobile home. He said, "I've asked you to come here because I think we share a common goal." Earlier, he had talked to them about forming an order like the one in the Turner Diaries, a group of kinsmen who had let their deeds do their talking for them. The goal was to carve out a part of eastern Washington as a homeland for the white race, purged of Jews and minorities. They would use the Turner Diaries as a blueprint for getting that done. Bob told the group he had set up a plan. He said it involved robbing pornography stores and pimps and counterfeiting money as a way to raise funds. It also involved assassinating both Jews and Gentiles who were contributing to the destruction of the white race. "I'm telling you now," Bob said, "if any of you don't want to get involved in this, you are free to leave." No one left. "I'm going to ask each of you to take an oath that you'll remain true to this cause," Bob continued. "I would like to remind all of you what is at stake here. It is our children, kinsmen, and their very economic and racial survival. Because of that, I would like to place a white child before us as we take this oath." A 6-week-old daughter of one of those present was placed in the center of the circle as a symbol of a Caucasian future they were about to pledge to create. She stared up at the figures looming above her in the glow of the candles. The men clasped hands and recited an oath of loyalty and commitment to their race and cause that Bob had written. And here's the oath. Direct quote, "I, as an Aryan warrior, swear myself to complete secrecy to the order and total loyalty to my comrades. Let me bear witness to you, my brothers, that should one of you fall in battle, I will see to the welfare and well-being of your family. Let me bear witness to you, my brothers, that should one of you be taken prisoner, I will do whatever is necessary to regain your freedom. Let me bear witness to you, my brothers, that should an enemy agent hurt you, I will chase him to the ends of the earth and remove his head from his body. And furthermore, let me bear witness to you, my brothers, that if I break this oath, let me be forever cursed upon the lips of our people as a coward and an oath breaker. My brothers, let us go forth by ones and twos, by scores and legions, and as true Aryan men with pure hearts and strong minds, face the enemies of our faith and our race with courage and determination. We hereby invoke the blood covenant and declare that we are in full state of war and will not lay down our weapons until we have driven the enemy into the sea and reclaimed the land which was promised our fathers of old, and through our blood and his will becomes the land of our children to be. End of the oath. Actually, the group did try, at least at the beginning, to raise money through legitimate means. They obtained a trail clearing contract with the U.S. Forest Service, but that didn't bring in enough money fast enough. So Bob and two others in the group robbed a pawn shop in Spokane, with one of Bob's partners in this undertaking slugging one of the clerks in the process. Their take was $36. Not much, but things escalated from there. Later on, Bob walked into a Seattle branch of Citibank, handed the teller a note, and walked off with almost $26,000. A snapshot exists of a smiling Bob Matthews in a long-sleeve flannel shirt, holding a Halloween trick-or-treat bag containing the money. Then there were the armored car holdups. The group captured the courier of an armored car while it was parked in front of a Fred Meyer's department store and made off with $43,000. And they hit another armored car, this one parked in front of a Bon Marché, or maybe it's Bon March, a retail outlet, and the take on that one was $500,000. So they were getting pretty good at it. As for terrorism, the order bombed an adult movie theater in downtown Seattle and a Boise, Idaho synagogue. Neither bomb did much damage. They began talking about whom to assassinate. People threw out names ranging from Henry Kissinger to David Rockefeller to Morris Deese of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The one they wound up taking out, quote-unquote, however, was a controversial Jewish radio call-in host from Denver by the name of Alan Berg. The killing later became the basis for the film Talk Radio, directed by Oliver Stone. It seems that one of the order had lived in the Denver area and was very put off by Berg, who went on monologues of the joys of oral sex, the flaws in Christianity, why whites were afraid of blacks, and how women fantasized about sleeping with black men. Berg particularly liked to egg on right-wing callers. Everything you said is a lie, okay? You have made up an inferred thought, like all fanatics, like John Birchers, like Klansmen, like all those folks. That's a direct quote from Berg. Bob masterminded the hit on Berg. He and several others of the order drove to Denver. They ambushed Berg getting out of his car in front of his apartment. One of the members of the order, not Bob, started firing from close up. Bullets hit Berg in the face, neck, and torso. The garage door behind Berg splintered from the spray of bullets. When Berg was found lying face up in a pool of blood, the cigarette he had been holding was still lit. Autopsy reports couldn't be sure how many shots there were because Berg was twisting at the time he was shot, although it was probably around 12. Two slugs struck near Berg's left eye and exited on the right side of his neck. Others hit the left side of Berg's head and exited from his neck and the back of his skull. The armored car stick-ups continued. The biggest one took place on the side of a highway near Ukiah, California, U-K-I-A-H, in the northern part of the state. Bob and 11 others in two pickup trucks forced a Brinks truck to stop and jumped out of their trucks wearing bandanas over their faces. One of them held up a sign that read, "Get out or die." Bob jumped onto the front bumper of the truck and shouted for the two guards to get out. But they seemed frozen and didn't move. One of the robbers, a man named Pierce, no relation, then proceeded to blow dime-sized holes in the windshield with an automatic weapon. That did the trick. The guards opened the door and scrambled out. All this was going on with traffic going by on the highway. People gawked as they went by, and some stopped up the road. It must have seemed unreal to the passers-by, like a movie. The group started a chain to unload the bags of money out of the money compartment in the back of the armored truck. Time was passing. They had given themselves 5 minutes to complete the job, and it was already approaching 7 minutes. Somebody could have called the highway patrol. A traffic jam, they hadn't thought of that until now, could block their way out. Bob was inside the truck, frantically scooping up money bags and passing them on. They had to get out of there. In all the excitement, Bob didn't notice that the 9mm pistol he was carrying had fallen out of his pocket. It later turned out to be a fateful error because the gun was eventually traced to him, and the FBI knew whom it was looking for. Finally, the men jumped in their pickups and sped away, tossing nails out of the back to slow down anyone chasing them. The order made a clean getaway, except for the gun left behind, and when they counted up the money, they found that the take was a whopping $3.6 million. They used some of the money for salaries, and most of them quit their regular jobs. Money went into things like mobile homes and a ski condo. They also purchased 110 acres in Idaho and 160 acres in Missouri to use as paramilitary camps. Money went for all-terrain vehicles and guns and ammunition. Two members of the group formed a company called Mountain Man Supply Company with the intention of using it to provide supplies to the order. But the use, or at least the alleged use, of the haul came from the Ukiah Brinks robbery that is of the most interest in this context, came about during Bob's trip east with Zilla Craig, who was the woman in his life by this point and pregnant with child. As far as I know, Bob never divorced Debbie. In September of 1984, Bob and Zilla went to Arlington, Virginia, and met with Bob's idol, William Pierce. Zilla said that Bob treated Pierce with reverence approaching worship. She reported that a baby grand piano took up much of one of the rooms in the small apartment that Pierce shared with his wife, his second. He had remarried in 1982. Zilla says that Pierce told them of his plans to move his operation to a tiny town in West Virginia called Mill Point. It was near the birthplace of the writer Pearl Buck, Pierce told them. Bob and Pierce then went into a bedroom, and Zilla didn't hear what they had talked about. She said she spent the time while Bob and Pierce were together with Pierce's wife, whose talk about her interest in parapsychology and the supernatural, Zilla said, gave her the, quote, creeps, unquote. Zilla says the next day she saw Bob put a large sum of money, she isn't sure how much it was, in a paper bag. Pierce, she says, came to her hotel, and he and Bob went outside and sat on a bench nearby. Through the window, Zilla says, she saw Bob give Pierce the paper bag. Jerry Dale, former county sheriff in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, reports that shortly after this meeting with Matthews was said to have taken place, Pierce paid $95,000 cash for the 346-acre plot of land on which he now lives. I remember getting the impression from my discussions with Pierce that the money for the West Virginia property came from donations from the people who attended his Sunday night meetings in Arlington and his own savings. Although, as I think about it, he hadn't really said specifically where the money had come from, only that he bought the land with the money he had, quote, accumulated, unquote. I decided not to ask Pierce straight out where he had obtained the money to buy the West Virginia property. If he had gotten it from Matthews, I wouldn't have expected him to say, sure, I bought this place with Brinks robbery loot, so I didn't see any point in bringing it up. I did talk to an individual who was close to the scene in those years, however, and when I asked him whether Pierce could have come up with that much money from the people who went to his Sunday night talks, he replied with a laugh, those people, they didn't have anything. I told Pierce about the comment of the individual I spoke to, and he replied, what that person told you was very misleading. The people who attended my cosmotheist meetings were mostly professionals. They did have money, and many of them gave it. I'll leave it there, says Griffin. Just like Pierce's fictional order in the Turner Diaries, Bob Matthews's order got into counterfeiting money. Along with the drop pistol, the counterfeiting activity turned out to be Bob's downfall. What happened is that one of the people who had agreed to help pass the money was a man named Thomas Martinez. Bob had met Martinez in the National Alliance. Martinez got caught trying to pass one of the fake bills and cut a deal with authorities. In return for the FBI going easy on him, Martinez would tell them where to find Matthews. Martinez told the FBI he was scheduled to meet Bob shortly at a Sheraton motel in Portland, Oregon, and they could follow him there. On the day of the meeting, FBI agents and Portland City SWAT team members converged on the motel. Bob was in room 42. The other guests were herded into the motel's small lounge and told to keep their heads down. Bob went outside of his room to stretch and spotted a man hiding in the bushes and realized what was up and bolted down the stairs past a female agent who fired a shot at him. The shot missed Bob and the slug smashed through the window of the lounge where the other guests were crouched and ricocheted off a stone fireplace. Somehow Bob got out of there and ran about two blocks down the street and got behind a concrete pillar next to an apartment complex. Bob later reported it was at this point he decided to stop being the hunted and become the hunter. A couple of officers chasing him ran up to the pillar and Bob fired, wounding one of them in the shin and foot. Bob later claimed that he had first aimed at the officer's head, but when he saw that he was a handsome white man, he lowered his aim. The other officer blasted a shotgun and the pellet smashed into Bob's exposed gun hand and searing pain shot up the arm and blood shot from the wound. Bob managed to escape, but the hand injury would throb for the remaining weeks that he had left to live. Bob managed to make it to a house on Whidbey Island off the coast of Seattle. There he wrote up a declaration of war, in quotes. The excerpts below give an indication of his mindset at that time. Extended quote here from Bob Matthews's of the Order's Declaration of War. It is now a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. All about us lie the green graves of our sires, yet in a land once ours we have become a people dispossessed. By the millions, those not of our blood violate our borders and mock our claim to sovereignty. Yet our people only react with lethargy. A great sickness has overcome us. Why do our people do nothing? What madness is this? Has the cancer of racial masochism consumed our very will to exist? Our heroes and our culture have been insulted and degraded. The mongrel hordes clamor to sever us from our inheritance. Yet our people do not care. Throughout this land, our children are being coerced into accepting non-whites for their idols, then their companions, and worst of all, their mates, a course which is taking us straight into oblivion. Yet our people do not see. Not by accident, but by design, these terrible things have come to pass. It is self-evident to all who have eyes to see that an evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. Evidence abounds that a certain vile alien people, he is obviously referring to Jews, says Griffin in brackets, have taken control over our country. All about us, the land is dying. Our cities swarm with dusky hordes. The water is rancid and the air is rank. Our farms are being seized by usurious leeches, another reference to Jews, and our people are being forced off the land. They close the factories, the mills, the mines, and ship our jobs overseas. Yet our people do not awaken. The Aryan yeomanry, small landholders, is awakening. A long-forgotten wind is starting to blow. Do you hear the approaching thunder? It is that of the awakened Saxon. War is upon the land. The tyrant's blood will flow. We will resign ourselves no more to be ruled by a government based on mobocracy. We, from this day forward, declare we no longer consider the regime in Washington to be valid and lawful representative of all Aryans who refuse to submit to the coercion and subtle tyranny placed upon us by Tel Aviv and their lackeys in Washington. We recognize that the mass of our people have been put into a lobotomized, lethargic state of blind obedience. We will not take part anymore in a collective racial suicide. This is war. The declaration of war was followed by a, quote, open letter to Congress, unquote. Excerpts. All of you together are not solely responsible for what has happened to America, but each of you, without exception, is partly responsible. And the day will come when each of you will be called to account for that responsibility. The day will come when your complicity in the betrayal of the 55,000 Americans who were sacrificed in Vietnam will be called to account. The day will come when your subservience to the anti-American Israel lobby will be called into account. Your votes to strip American arsenals so that Zionists can hold on to stolen land, and your acquiescence in a policy which has turned our Arab friends into enemies, those things are inexcusable. The day will come when, above all else, you will pay for betraying your race. Most of you will say that you are against the forced racial busing of school children, that you are against the reverse discrimination, quote unquote, which takes jobs away from whites and gives them to blacks, that you are against the flooding of America with illegal immigrants because you know these things are unpopular. But you brought every one of these plagues down on our heads. You passed the civil rights laws which gave us busing in the first place, and then you refused repeatedly to specifically outlaw this monstrous crime against our children. It was your scramble for black votes and your cowardice in the face of the controlled news media which allowed our cities to become crime-infested jungles. You set up the requirements that employers had to meet racial quotas, and you passed the immigration laws which started the flood of non-white immigrants into America, a flood that is out of control. We hold you responsible for all these things, for every white child terrorized in a racially mixed school, For every white person murdered in one of our urban jungles, for every white woman raped by one of the arrogant equals roaming our streets, for every white family hungry and desperate because a white worker's job was given to a black, each day the list grows longer, but the day will come when the whole score will be settled and you will pay for every one of these debts in full. End of the letter to Congress. On November 25, 1984, Bob wrote a letter to a small weekly newspaper in Newport, Washington, which said, "It is logical to assume that my days on this planet are rapidly drawing to a close. Even so, I have no fear, for the reality of life is death. I have made the ultimate sacrifice to secure the future for my children. As always, for blood, honor, for faith, and for race." On December 7th, 2 weeks after he wrote that letter, the FBI had the Whidbey Island house surrounded. They'd caught up with Bob again. He was alone in the house. This time they were going to be sure that he didn't get away. 100 agents surrounded the house. They cut off his electricity. They attempted to negotiate through a bullhorn. "Come out and we won't harm you." Bob was having none of that. He wasn't coming out of there. His hand mangled and throbbing, he opened fire with an automatic weapon. The standoff went on through the night and into the next day. By this time, the press had converged on the site. The FBI lofted in tear gas. Bob must have had a gas mask. He continued to fire. Da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They issued an ultimatum. "Give up or we're coming in to get you." More automatic weapon fire from Bob. At 3 p.m. on that day, December 8th, a SWAT team went into the house. When they got inside, bullets rained down on them through the ceiling from the floor above. The SWAT team returned fire as they retreated. Later that evening, after it had gotten dark, a helicopter flew over the house and dropped white phosphorus illumination flares onto the roof. The house ignited and flame shot 100 feet into the air. Bullets came ripping through the walls from inside the burning house. Bob was still firing away. The agents kept down as the slugs whistled through the night air and split the trees above them. Then everything was still. The next morning, in the charred ruins of the house, they found a body burned beyond recognition. Dental records determined it to be that of Bob Matthews. "Bob was a very intense young man," Pierce told me, "and quite different from the weaklings I see so many of in America today. If Bob saw a situation that called for intervention or action, he would jump up and do something, while other people would just talk about it. The typical male these days might talk with his buddies about what ought to be done, say, to the government. He might even express his outrage, but he wouldn't do anything. He wouldn't do what any respectable white male 100, 200, 1,000 years ago would have done. But Bob Matthews was different in that regard. He was a serious man who took things seriously. It was what impressed me about him and made me respect him and remember him more than anything else. It wasn't that he was a great thinker. He was more of an activist. He distributed leaflets and organized, things like that. He was a National Alliance member and came to our national meeting in Washington in 1983. Bob had been passing out leaflets and books and organizing up in his part of the country for a couple of years. The economic situation with a lot of the people he had been working with, truckers, forest workers, farmers, was pretty grim. There were a lot of repossessions of farm. That was a big thing in the early 80s, was the government had encouraged a lot of farmers to go into a debt to expand their land, and when the interest rates changed, a lot of them went bankrupt. There were a lot of repossessions of farms, and a lot of people were out of work, and Bob had decided the time for tougher action had come. He didn't see what he had been doing up to then was making a big difference. Bob was a very frustrated and impatient young man. He gave a talk at our meeting. I wouldn't call it a skillful oration exactly, but it came from the heart. After Bob's talk at the convention, I got together with him and said, "Bob, you gave a very good talk. But don't be misled by the fact that people up in the Pacific Northwest that you were around seem a bit more revolutionary mood than the rest of the country," and jumped the gun. See, he had the idea that if he started something, he could provide an example that others would follow. This Aryan Nations outfit is nearby in Hayden Lake, Idaho, and he visited there and he recruited some of those people. And he got some people from around where he lived in Washington State. I suppose he had around 20 people involved with him at his peak, although there were maybe 8 or 9 of them that were core members of his operation. They started robbing banks and heisting armored cars and so forth. God, the things they were doing were really breathtaking. Not only was Bob knocking over banks and so forth, but he and his group were going around the country recruiting people for their revolutionary army. He thought that this effort of his could snowball. The technique went something like this. They'd come into some city, Atlanta, say, and they would rent a house and fill up a couple of tables in the house with stacks of money from their latest bank robbery and some copies of the Turner Diaries and hand grenades and machine guns and whatever else they had. They had this list of supposed patriots in the area. Sometimes in a previous town they would ask, "We're going to Atlanta next. Do you know anybody who'd be a good prospect for us?" And so they would get a list of names and addresses. Bob thought that when people saw all the money they had heisted and the military weapons and so on, they would say, "Sign me up, and I have three friends. Let me get them on the telephone and get them over here." So Bob and his group would bring the people on their list over to their safe house, as they called it, CIA terminology they had adopted, and they would say, "Okay, the revolution has started, and you've been chosen to participate." The guy's eyes would bug out, and he would see the table full of money and machine guns, and typically what would happen is he'd say, "Oh, great, that's wonderful, the revolution has started. Yeah, you know, I've got to think about this for a little while, guys. Let me go home and talk to my wife, and I'll get right back to you." And zoom, this guy's ass doesn't touch his shirt until he had put a lot of distance between himself and Matthews and the rest of them. He'd get home and call up all the people he knew, and he'd say, "God damn, you know what I just saw?" He'd be all excited, and he'd talk about it, and it would end right there. He'd be sympathetic and everything, but he wasn't trying to mess these guys up. But he wasn't going to stick his neck out. How Bob managed to last as long as he did, I'll never know. He survived one shootout with the FBI in a motel up in Portland. His hand was hit with buckshot. What led to his downfall was he got into counterfeiting money, an activity the Turner Diaries order did as well, and one of the members of the group was caught passing and then turned. Tom Martinez, that's the one. Martinez had been in the National Alliance. That's where Bob first got together with him. Bob had a few good soldiers who were willing to follow him and do what he told them to do to the best of their ability, but he also had some defective people like Martinez. I'd had to throw him out of the Alliance. What happened was that Martinez had a pal in Philadelphia, where he was from, by the name of Howard Brown. The Alliance unit leader up there was Alan Balogh, B-A-L-O-G-H, basically a good, sturdy fellow. Balogh would do things like staple Alliance placards to telephone poles, and he would punch out anybody who gave him a bad time while he was doing it. Sometimes this would result in legal difficulties, and one time when Balogh got fined $500, I took up a collection at one of our national conventions to pay his fine. Well, the next year, Martinez and Brown wanted me to take up a collection for them because they had been fined for disorderly conduct. They had been talking loudly in a restaurant about niggers, and some liberal white woman took exception to it and made some politically correct remarks to them, and Martinez, Brown, and the woman got into an argument. The manager told Martinez and Brown to get out, and they left with a lot of words and threats. The manager called the police, and the police picked them up and arrested them for disorderly conduct. I thought the two of them had used poor judgment and had behaved in a manner I did not want from Alliance members. Plus, I had had problems of this sort before with Martinez. At the next annual convention, Martinez got up and said that since I had taken up a collection last year for this same kind of thing, I ought to do it again. I explained the difference between last year's situation and this one. In this case, the two of them hadn't accomplished anything useful. They were on enemy territory, etc. It was just poor judgment and bad behavior on their part. Whereas last year, Balogh was doing a reasonable thing, putting up our posters where others could see them, a good activity that I encourage, and he punched out a heckler only as a last resort. Martinez stayed up drinking until 4 a.m. and was going on about how I didn't have any sympathy for the ordinary working guy out in the street, and he went around and took up a collection on his own in the face of what I had said about not wanting it, so I threw him out. Anyway, Martinez took a bunch of counterfeit money and bought some beer with it in Philadelphia. The money wasn't especially good, and the clerk at the store called the police, and they grabbed him when he, dumb, came back to the very same place the next night to buy more beer. Martinez sees he's in trouble and throws Matthews to them to save himself. I talked to Bob's widow, Debbie, afterwards, and I told her I felt somewhat responsible. Bob was obviously very much taken with the Turner Diaries, and it was clear he drew a lot of the elements from the book in the way he did things and the terminology he used and so on. I told her I had told Bob that I didn't think the country was in a revolutionary mood and had urged him not to do this, but maybe I could have said it better. She said it wouldn't have made any difference what I had told Bob. He had made up his mind that this is what he was going to do, and he figured he wasn't going to survive it. Bob, obviously being inspired by my book, made for a big problem for me after it happened. The secret police were on my neck for years. They were all over this country, and they really wanted to haul me in. I thought I was going to get indicted and put on trial with those others down in Fort Smith. And then a parenthetical paragraph. In 1987, the Justice Department brought sedition charges against 13 individuals identified with white racialist groups and activities. The indictment accused them of conspiring to overthrow the United States government. After a lengthy trial with over 100 witnesses and thousands of pages of documents, all the defendants were acquitted. Undoubtedly, Pierce's concerns had to do not only with the possibility of a conviction and jail time, but also the time and energy that a trial would require, and the likelihood that no matter what its outcome, it would drain, if not break him financially. What impressions of Bob Matthews stick with you? Well, there's his charisma and his leadership ability. But the main thing for me, says Pierce, is that Bob was just a very honest and sincere sort of person. He was the sort of person you need very badly if you're going to have a revolution. A person who is totally dedicated, who will put his life on the line without even thinking about it, who will do whatever it takes, whether it means machine-gunning a crowd of people or walking into the jaws of death. Bob was ready to do it, and not because he was a thrill-seeker or wanted attention or praise. He was ready to do it because it needed to be done. And let that be the final word of the chapter and Pierce's final words about Bob Matthews of the Order.